We only have a few minutes here for questions, and I've solicited some questions from audience members, and I think that folks in the audience here will be respectful of the fact that we actually have to get Amy out the door at 7:30 so she can get back to New York because she tapes early in the morning, and we don't want Democracy Now! To be without her. Clearly, it's very important. So let me ask first, Amy and David, because both of you mentioned this, do you think that new media, primarily web-based, create an expanded opportunity for democratic journalism that is independent of corporate and commercial interests? Or do you think that already they are so diffuse, poorly funded, and lacking in journalistic standards that they do little more than create noise?
Well, I just want to say very quickly, I originally come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded 61 years ago. 1949, a man named Lou Hill was a war resistor, came out of the detention camps and said, there's got to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. First station, KPFA in Berkeley. Second station, KPFK in Los Angeles in 1959. My station in New York, WBAI, 1960. Washington has WPFW, KPFT, Houston. That station went on the air in 1970. It's now 40 years old, in fact, this week. And when it went on the air, within a few months, it was blown up. It was the Ku Klux Klan. They strapped dynamite to the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. And I can't remember if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is, because it allows people to speak for themselves. And that is the power right now that we all have in this globalized communication system. It can go one of two ways. It can either be shut down, which is why we have to support net neutrality, that, you know, just sort of buzzword for keeping the internet open. But we have hundreds of channels. Don't be fooled by them. They're owned by just a handful of media moguls. We have to diversify the means of communication, challenge the gatekeepers, open it up. And I think that's only a good thing. I mean, sure, the internet can be a global rumor mill, and you have a real responsibility to double check and triple check, just like when you're doing papers or anything else, to really check, get down to, you know, how you can verify what is there. But at its best, it is a way to find information that those gatekeepers have kept from us for so long. And we have a responsibility to do this because we come from the most powerful country on earth. And it is our responsibility to find out our effect on the world.
I think it's telling this idea of journalistic standards, and it's useful to bring that up because we can reflect back on where were those standards at the launch of the Iraq War, when we had the picture of the entire U.S. media with very few exceptions acting as a megaphone for the lies of the Bush administration, acting as a critical part of the propaganda machinery. And so when we talk about the basic tasks of a journalist, to back it up, to get other sources, to go to at the ground level, to find out what is the story, not just at the government end, at the, through the scope of the rifle, but at the target end, to find out the stories in the communities, in Iraq, in Iraqi hospitals. Here we are embedding soldiers, embedding reporters with soldiers, or as we write in our book, in bed with the military. Where were those same reporters? Why weren't they embedded in the communities in Iraq, in the hospitals, in the peace movement around the world, where unprecedented millions of people were turning out in London and in Paris at anti-war rallies? So I think it's very useful and important that these other vehicles for getting the story out have now forced the question of, yes, journalistic standards, they should be held to this, we should be held to a higher standard, certainly a higher standard than the corporate media has given us.
And you know, all of our books, we've used the motto of what the independent media we think should be. The first was called the exception to the rulers. That's what the media should be, the exception to the rulers. The latest book, my book of columns, Breaking the Sound Barrier. And our second book was called Static. And the reason we called it Static, that was David's choice, was in this high-tech digital age with digital radio, high-definition television, still all we ever get is static, a veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths, when what we need is the media to give us the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And a media that covers the movements, and a media that covers the movements that create static and make history.
Here's a related question. Mainstream news cover activism in very predictable ways, omitting political issues in favor of logistical details when they cover it at all. In what ways do you think activists can gain standing in the news as legitimate political voices?
The media denigrates activists, yet what could be more noble than devoting your life to making the world a better place? We begin standing up to the madness with the story of Rosa Parks. And you might think, well, everyone knows that story. Why repeat it? Well, it really goes to this point of activism. No, people don't quite know the story of Rosa Parks. I remember when she died a few years ago, Democracy Now! Raced to Washington. There was a big, well, she was the first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Her body was then brought to a church. Thousands came out before the big funeral in Detroit. And the media said Rosa Parks, you know, was a remarkable woman, and she absolutely was, that she was simply a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. But that's where they got it wrong. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker, right? Rosa Parks knew exactly what she was doing on December 1st, 1955, when she sat down on the bus in Montgomery and launched the Montgomery bus boycott. She didn't know that's what would happen, but you know, she had actually done this before. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked under Edie Nixon, who was the president who came out of radical labor politics. She trained at the Highlander Center, where Dr. King had also been. Black and white together, working to most effectively strategize to challenge the racist laws in the South. When she sat down on that bus, she wasn't the first one. Other women had sat down in the bus. She herself had sat down in the bus before and refused to get up for a white passenger. You never know when that magic moment will come, right? But you can help to lay the foundation. And that moment came on December 1st, and she made history. And to show how brave she was, and this is where the media misses out, is they don't show the movements. They don't give you the historical context. Understand, Rosa didn't just come out of nowhere, so a young person watches it. I would never have that courage. She came out of a movement and inspired a movement. But to show how incredibly brave she was, a few months before, Emmett Till, 14-year-old boy, African-American. His mom sends him to be with family in Mississippi in the hot summer from Chicago, and he's lynched. He is killed by a white mob, and he's dragged out of bed, his uncle and aunt's house, in the middle of the night, and he ends up in the Tallahatchie River. And when his body was brought to Chicago to be buried, his mother, Mamie Till, did something incredibly brave. She said she wanted the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. Thousands streamed by his casket and saw his distended head, his mutilated head. And Jet Magazine and other black publications took pictures, and they were shown. They were published in their magazines and newspapers. And they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. I think Mamie Till had something very important to teach the media of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw the babies dead on the ground in Iraq? We saw the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs or drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan. We saw the soldiers dead and dying. If we saw that on top of the fold of the surviving newspapers of this country, the photographs and the stories, if we saw it as the top of every newscast in this country for just 1 week, every single day, 24 hours a day, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. So it's our responsibility in the media to get these images out, not to talk about what's appropriate or tasteful. I think the problem is that war is not tasteful or perhaps appropriate, that there are more, that we are at a point in civilization where we can solve things in a different way, and we have to bring out the alternatives. And the people who have worked on those issues for so long are the activists. They are iced out of the media, but we have a lot of possibilities now because it's not just the three major corporate networks that are controlling the stories that you read or the people you meet. And you, too, can be the media makers. You are the me in media.
Okay, we have time for one last question. Some people criticize journalists like Nick Kristof, Amy Goodman, David Goodman, for stepping over the line and accuse you of not being an objective journalist.
Of being a human being. We accept the criticism.
Thank you. Tell us, is there anything wrong with this type of journalism?
I think there's something wrong with journalism that passes itself off as being objective and, in fact, has an agenda behind it that is not the agenda of telling the truth. And I think, you know, we see that, you know, nowadays to be, well, and for quite some time, to be for war is to be objective. And we saw that and we see that as we see the parade of generals that gets trotted out every time the United States goes to war. Suddenly they are brought in as objective analysts. It gives new meaning to the term general news. We write about this in our books, but you know, you have the example of one of the top people for both NBC and CNN is also on the board of a company that's profiting from the weapons that he is describing in the most fawning terms, you know, show with the video game style, you know, presentation of the bombs that are being dropped and the planes that are used to drop them. So I think we have to take a very hard look at who's called objective. Basically, pro-war is being rewarded no matter how many times you are wrong. It's the only job you can fail at, be wrong at on national TV, and get a promotion.
Just to be objective, look at the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a good group called fair.org based in New York, did a study of the 2 weeks around Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, giving his push for war at the UN on February 5th, 2003, like 5-6 weeks before the invasion. FAIR looked at the four major nightly newscasts, NBC Nightly News, CBS Evening News, ABC World News Tonight, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. In that 2 week period, what's so critical, that's the period where the media is manufacturing consent, as Noam Chomsky says, manufacturing consent for war. In that 2 week period, there were 393 interviews done around war. These are the four major nightly newscasts. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders?
Zero.
That's an underestimate, zero. Two, underestimate. Three of almost 400. That is no longer a mainstream media. Because, you know, those who are opposed to war, those who are opposed to torture, are not a fringe minority. They're not even a silent majority. They're the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. As journalists, we have an obligation to be fair and accurate. Everyone has an opinion, but it's to be fair and accurate, and that's what we attempt to do every day.
Thank you. I want to just mention to you all that Amy is going to be back with us on April 5th, where we're going to have our second Inside the Activist study, and Amy will be interviewing environmentalist, author, and activist Bill McKibben. So I hope that everybody will be able to come back then. That promises to be another really exciting event. So please, everyone, join me in thanking Amy and David Goodman for giving us a fabulous start to this series.
Thank you.